lights are spiraling towards each other. The low moans of distant black holes devouring stars at the hearts of galaxies. It hears them all, and creates a unique signature, a key with which it encrypts the incoming message. Every device carries those messages, but they can't be read out until the device satisfies itself that the gravitational background is the same, or nearly the same. It has allowed for the spatial position of the message recipient, of course. That gives the devices an effective range of a few thousand light-years, apparently. Once they get separated beyond that distance, they just don't recognize the background signature as being correct anymore. And any attempt to fake that background, to try and predict what the future gravitational signature of the universe will be like, based on the known contributions, well, it never seems to work. The devices just fold up and die, apparently. For centuries, then, the grub must have been able to keep in some kind of contact with its remote allies. Then it had begun to approach the message store limit of its own communicational device, and had begun to transmit only sparingly. The enemy, it was said, had access to those messages as well as their own copies of the devices, so there was always a danger in using them. The creature had imagined that it had been lonely before, when it was being chased, but now it began to understand that it had never really known solitude. Solitude was a hard, crushing force, akin to the mountains of rock above it. Yet it had stayed sane, allowing itself to talk to its allies every few tens of years, maintaining a fragile sense of kinship, that it still played a small role in the greater arena of grub affairs. But Ferris had removed the grub from its ship, severing it with the communicational device. That must have been the start of the creature's true descent into grub madness. "You milk it, don't you?" I said, "milk it for dream fuel. And more than that, you use its terror and loneliness. You distill those impressions and sell them." Ferris piped, "We've got probes sunk into his brain, reading his neural patterns. Run them through some software up in the Rust Belt, and we get to distill it into something a human can just about handle." "What's he talking about?" Zebra asked. "Experientials," I said, "the black kind, with a small maggot motif near the top. I tried one, as a matter of fact. I didn't know quite what to expect."
"I've heard of them," Zebra said, "but I've never tried one. And I wasn't even sure they weren't an urban myth."
"No, they're for real." I remembered the welter of emotions that the experiential had fed into my brain when I tried it aboard the Stelnikov. The predominant feeling had been of awful, crushing claustrophobia and fear, yet underpinned with the gut-churning sense that, no matter how oppressive the claustrophobia was, it was preferable to the predator-haunted void beyond. I could still taste the terror that the experiential had instilled in me, subtly alien in flavor, yet recognizable for all that. At the time, I'd had trouble understanding why people would pay to experience something like that. But now it all made much more sense. It was all about extremes of experience. Anything that would blunt boredom's edge.
"What does he get for doing it?" Zebra asked.
"Relief," said Ferris. I saw what he meant. Down in the black slime which filled the tank, grey-suited workers were sloshing around with what looked like huge cattle prods. They were knee-deep in the black stuff. Now and then one of them would run the tip of his prod across the grey side of the maggot, causing a shiver of pain to run along its blimp-like length. Pale red stuff squirted out of pores in his mottled, silvery skin. One of the workers moved to catch it in a flask. At the other end, a high, shrill squeal sounded from his mouthparts. "I guess he isn't making..."